Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. And today we're doing In the News. This is our regular look at the news stories that have been going on in the world as we offer some sort of comment on them. With me today, I've got Adrian Reynolds, our head of national ministries. Hello, Adrian.
Hello, Phil.
Oh, Adrian's not very well, everybody. This is terrible. It's man flu. It's not just ordinary flu.
It's been a bit worse than man.
Brother, you have been in bed this week.
I have.
And we are sorry. Thankfully, you're on the mend. But Adrian's feeling a little bit hoarse, it's fair to say.
Flowers to the FIC office.
Yeah, that'll be fine. That's fine. Yeah. there we go. And National Director John Stevens is here as well. Good morning. John doesn't have a cold, which is good.
Not yet.
But he might have by the end. The next half hour, we'll all get it. Brilliant. Well, where should we start this week, brothers? I think yesterday, we were recording this on Friday morning. Yesterday was the autumn statement. Jeremy Hunt's making his autumn statement, his first as Chancellor. Obviously, the cost of living crisis is dominating the headlines. And I think it was all laid bare for us yesterday. We're going to enter some really choppy waters financially. I think in my lifetime, probably the choppiest that I've seen. It looks like it might even be worse than after the financial crash in 2007-8. I mean, how do we respond to that? Then we can think about how churches might help their congregations. John, your reaction to yesterday?
Yeah, I think the first reaction is the government is responding to what looks like a very significant crisis
of their own making.
Partly of their own making. I mean, the Office of Budget Responsibility report makes clear there are a number of factors that are contributing to the worsening economic situation, of which inflation is a huge part, which is partly a result of the kind of COVID crisis and coming out of the COVID crisis, the costs of that, people being ill, not returning into the workplace. The war in Ukraine has had a massive factor because of the rising costs of energy, which have pushed up food costs, which is behind a large amount of inflation. So that's a significant factor. The quasi Kwarteng Liz Truss mini budget has made things more difficult because it spooked the markets, which meant that the costs of borrowing for Britain have increased. So some of the ways of dealing with a recession that's developing are not available to us because of that spooking of the markets that's made it more costly. And the other element that is in the Office of Budget Responsibility report and was mentioned by the Governor of the Bank of England this week is the implications of Brexit. Mm. Although the government hasn't wanted to comment on that at all, and I think nobody's been willing to point that out, but the indications are that that is leading to a lower GDP of about 4%. The Governor of the Bank of England said 6% of food inflation is directly related to Brexit and not being part of the single market in the way that we were. So when you have those factors alongside the other factors, it means we're facing a very significant national challenge. Basically, the economy is not able at the current level of taxation to sustain public spending, particularly benefits, pensions, defence, education. So in the end, something has to give because we can't borrow more because borrowing is so much more expensive, has to be paid for. So I think what has happened is it's been a reality check. The last sort of mini budget under Kwasi Kwarteng, they didn't publish the OBR report. They didn't comment on it. So that was a kind of an act of faith. This is much more a recognition of a kind of reality. Mm. And I think there's a lesson for us there. How do you deal with difficult situations? Do you act in faith in the hope that it will get better and you'll be able to solve it? Or do you face up to the reality of what's happening? Now, having said all of that, although the picture is bleak, it's worth saying that an awful lot of the tax increases and the spending cuts have been pushed into the future. And it may not turn out to be as bad as it is predicted.
So there's chance for it to recover in terms of the next couple of years.
Well, yeah. For example, if the war in Ukraine comes to an end or if energy prices drop, then the picture will substantially improve next summer.
You can only plan with what's in front of you, I
Indeed.
Guess.
Indeed. So at one level, the Office of Budget Responsibility is tasked with producing kind of almost worst case scenario kind of predictions. And government has been forced into having to respond to those because of what happened in the mini budget. Whether it turns out to be quite like that, I think is a different question. But most people and most commentators have recognised the Chancellor didn't have many options. He had a very difficult hand to play, and it's hard to see what anybody else would do. And it's interesting listening to the criticisms from other parties who are obviously blaming the current government for the economic crisis and where we are. But they're not really at this point proposing alternative solutions for how to deal with it. It looks as though we're in a situation in which there are very few options and government has sought to try to balance the books and protect the most vulnerable.
I think that's quite interesting because if they'd gone for a general election and as people predicted, Labour had swept to power, if they'd not fixed it day one, then people would be saying, pointing the finger at the Labour Party, wouldn't they? It just seems a bit mad.
I think that's probably true. But I mean, that's politics, isn't it? Yeah. And the problem is these things are always tinged with politics. So I think you're right, John, that it's certainly more grown up than the last statement. There's no doubt about that. And I think it's more honest about the realities. But it's not completely honest about the realities. There is, as you said, a denial about the Brexit.
Interesting impact, on that, though, which, some commentators saying whatever happens with Brexit, we will have to rejoin some version of the single market, probably.
Well, let's not get into that.
No, okay, fair enough.
I just think in terms of being honest about what has caused it, you know, the headline is this is a, you know, essentially our problem at the moment is made in Russia. And that's partly true, but not entirely true. And I think in terms of dealing with difficult issues in church leadership, the lesson is, actually, it's sometimes quite easy to give part explanations for things, which can seem politically wise at the time. But I think full transparency, as much as possible, is always important in church leadership. Mm. So once you start giving one of, you know, let's say there are two or three reasons why something has happened, and you give one to try and just sort of, you know, appear to be transparent, but actually you're not telling people about the other two. You haven't actually been honest in your leadership. And I think, that's what happens in politics. I'm not expecting much more from politicians, don't worry. But I think in church leadership, we should be different. And we do need to be more analytical and careful about the reasons why things have happened and gone wrong, and be honest about them. I think that's really, really important.
And I think we recognise that in the ministry of Jesus, as he teaches with a transparency and openness, as he proclaims the good news of the kingdom, Jesus both makes very clear that there is a cost that needs to be paid. There is a sort of a cost of rejecting him. There is a cost of following him and the sort of suffering that will go with sort of following the Lord Jesus into the kingdom. There isn't a kind of a cakeism that simply says, you believe in me and everything will be all right, everything will be solved, it will all be kind of wonderful tomorrow. There is a realism in the way that the sort of the gospel is preached by Jesus. Yeah. And I think that's a lesson. Politicians tend to want to tell people what they want to hear. Mm. Whereas actually in gospel ministry, as we proclaim the good news of the gospel, we need to tell people the truth of what they need to hear. I think it'd be interesting how the public responds to this budget. Do people kind of, will they appreciate that this is the reality of the situation that we're in? And people individually are having to deal with their own budgets, make cuts, make savings. They're facing those hard choices themselves. Maybe there'll be a realization that actually that has to be done at a more national level, that people will be tired of promises that simply can't be delivered, that have kind of presented a rosier picture than is reality.
Mm. Can I just push that through a little bit and just work that through in an example, just to explain what I was trying to say? That, for example, let's say you've got an elder who resigns, and he resigns because he doesn't agree, strongly disagrees with the decision the church leadership have made collectively. The temptation might be you don't want to sow division in the church. So what you do is you say to the church, well, Bob has resigned as an elder. We really thank him for all his years of long service. The main reason he's resigned is because actually he hasn't got time to do his eldership work as well as spend time, quality time with his family and his lay job and all the rest of it. And there may be some truth in that. But if you're not telling the church the other bit of information as well, which you know to be true, actually, you are sowing division ultimately. Mm. And now they're going to be, you have to be careful. You have to do things in an appropriate way. And some things, especially pastoral issues, you can't share all the details of, obviously. But actually, you just end up creating rods for your own back. And I think that's the problem with politics. That's why we get the cyclical nature of politics, is if we're not honest about the situations we're in and the difficulties we're facing, entirely honest about them, it always comes back to bite you.
Can I ask about giving to church? So it might be as people get squeezed, they reassess their own finances. How can churches, church leaders prepare for maybe a drop in giving? There may not be, but they may see a drop in giving, people having to tighten their belts. Am I overthinking that, or is that something churches should be actively thinking about and preparing for? And how can they do that wisely?
I think history shows actually that church giving is remarkably resilient. Mm. And at times when we think church giving is going to catastrophically decline, it tends not to. And then this is for churches who get most of their income through bank accounts. I think if you have cash plate giving, it's a slightly different situation. Some churches will be in that situation. But actually, people that thought at the beginning of COVID thought there was going to be a crisis. In the last financial crisis, really church incomes didn't diminish as much as you might have expected otherwise. So very often, standing orders are the last things that people
look at.
You know, they see the bill which comes through the letterbox, from the electricity company, but they don't necessarily, or through the email, they don't necessarily see in the same way. You don't get an invoice, do you, from the church? And so it doesn't feature in the same way. So just psychologically and actually spiritually, there's often a lag. It often is different. I think, and we've said this before, we need to give in our churches permission for people to reduce their giving and increase their giving. There will be some people who will be remarkably resilient. And we were just chatting beforehand. There are some people who in our churches are very well off and actually probably should give more, frankly. And, you know, you look at some of the starting salaries for graduates, or some of the lawyers' starting salaries in graduates are well over six figures now in London, and for accountants. And so actually there are people who are earning very significant sums. I think perhaps a more pressing issue, and one that we're not so good at resolving, is how we are fair between churches. You know, there will be churches that do well or do okay, keep their head above the water, and there will be churches who really struggle. And actually, it seems to me a New Testament principle is we should be on the lookout for those in need and be looking to find ways to support them.
I mean, interestingly, in the way the Chancellor has tried to balance it, this idea that those who have the broadest shoulders have to carry the greatest load is the mantra that's used to describe where the sort of tax burden falls. And at one level, that's a thoroughly biblical principle in the life of the church. And we have to recognise that within our church communities, there will be those who are poor and are really hardly badly impacted by increased costs of food, increased costs of a kind of heating, and they don't have any extra income. And actually for them, it's entirely right that they reduce their giving to church because they've got to put those priorities first. At the same time, there may be people in church, how you judge wealth, there are some people who may look reasonably wealthy, but actually they have little disposable income because of their commitments, their mortgage, their children, their food. So actually you can't make easy judgments as to what people might have in terms of their capacity to give. There may be others who have assets, savings, the Chancellor has protected pensioners. Many pensioners who are wealthier and own their own homes are going to do really well out of increased kind of pensions, and they don't have the costs of mortgages. So in many of our churches, some of those people may need to give more. And in our church, as we think about our church budget and what the church needs to be able to do to support properly its staff and its ministries, it means those in the church community who have more, who are more able to cut back, maybe have assets that they could give rather than simply saving them for the future for themselves, they may in the short term need to give more to help the church through this period of time. This may well be a couple of years period of challenge. And in that period, certain people in the church may well need to be considerably more generous to ensure that the church as a whole, and actually in some ways, I think back to Adrian's point, that means a transparency to the church members about the budget and the financial situation.
Yeah.
So we need to be saying to our church, if we want to do these things and pay our staff and meet our costs, we're going to have to, as a body, increase our giving. And some of you may well need to give considerably more to help us through this period because you're more able to. Yeah.
And worth saying as well, if you're a non-paid leader and you're listening to this podcast, do be looking after your paid staff because they're likely to be at the, you know, you need to find out what their financial situation is. They may well be in greater financial difficulty. A lot of church staff are reasonably low paid and may need help.
Yeah, thank you. Let's move on. John, have you put your England flag up? Is it hanging out over your window at home?
Cricket, yes.
Cricket, but not...
The World Cup. That's the World Cup I'm interested
in.
That's
the one, so, the one you want
glorious
to talk
victory.
About.
So, you know, we won the kind of T20. So I am a World Cup supporting England fan.
Very good. Extraordinary story this morning about the Qatar World Cup that we were talking about just before we came on. That now all the planes have landed and
bring
everybody's
your own
there.
Bottle now,
they've basically decided they're not going to serve alcohol in the stadiums, which is just seems extraordinary to me to do that at the 11th hour. But I think that demonstrates something, that there's been a huge amount of criticism of Qatar as a nation, human rights abuses, a particular focus on the LGBT community and Qatar's positioning towards those from that community. But what's not really been reported on is the persecution of Christian believers in Qatar. 18th on the World Watch List with Open Doors. Indigenous believers particularly face huge persecution in Qatar. I mean, it's not a good look, is it, for the World Cup? And I think, you know, the reporting has obviously been skewed in a particular direction, but we need to remember there are persecuted believers in Qatar as well.
Yeah, that's right. And just to set it in a wider context, though, Phil, I wrote an article on this for the website. My first memory is 1978 World Cup in Argentina. And that was a despotic regime as well. There'd been a military coup. Hunter was ruling the nation, that there are stories of concentration camps within earshot of the stadiums. They could hear the matches being played in the stadiums while people were in concentration camps. Yeah. So this is not new. Mm. Actually, 1978 got a lot of coverage. Johan Cruyff famously refused to go. So I don't think there's anything new in terms of the FIFA stroke corruption stroke despotic regimes.
Four years ago, we were all cheering on a World Cup in Russia, weren't we?
We have been here before. Yeah. I think there's much more media attention being given to it this time round. And I think that's a good thing, actually. Mm. I think there is change afoot in FIFA. I think it unlikely that going into the future we'll see the same kind of underhand, what appear to be underhand corruption and bribery going on in quite the same way. So I think actually media pressure is having an effect on FIFA. But actually, to impact nations, it's very, very hard, isn't it? So I think as Christians, we need to know that our weapons are not the weapons the world fights with. And actually, they are very powerful. So I think we should take great comfort from the fact that we can be praying for believers in Qatar. I think there's a great resource from Open Doors to help you pray through the World Cup and think about that. But you're absolutely right. It is an oppressive regime. Lots of people are oppressed, and Christians amongst them are terribly treated. I mean, it's not an enormous country by any means.
2.8 million, I think. Yeah.
So it's pretty tiny, and it's not a footballing nation at all, is it? Mm, but yes, you're absolutely right to highlight it, Phil.
Interesting. Open Doors website talks about if you are an immigrant in Qatar, you're freer to worship. It really is the indigenous believers who are particularly impacted.
Yeah. And I think that's true of an awful lot of Muslim countries. So they might allow churches to meet. They might allow people who are not Muslim by birth to be Christian, but they don't allow people who are Muslim by birth to be converted. You can see that in Malaysia with lots of restrictions on being able to kind of evangelize the Malay population, countries that require people to have their religion on their identity card and they can't change it. And it's not just Qatar. I mean, actually the persecution of Christians around the world is growing. There was a report that was published this week that was speaking about increased persecutions of Christians around the world, largely in Islamic contexts, particularly in kind of Nigeria. And I think from the perspective of our context in the West, one of the things about this Qatar story, it just reminds us that the persecution of Christians around the world is not big on the kind of agenda of the media. Mm. We live in a culture in which we sort of are concerned about oppression, concerned about injustice, concerned about inequality. But it's quite clear that the different inequalities that there are not treated in the same way. So LGBTQ rights always gain massive amounts of attention, despite the fact that it's a very small percentage of most populations. But yet the persecution of Christians, where very often it's large numbers of people who are being persecuted simply because of their religious belief, gains almost no media attention, which I think suggests just something about the way that in our culture, Christianity has declined. It's not seen as an issue. The media is not particularly sympathetic to that. To be fair to government, they have been concerned about issues of religious freedom. So Philip Mount Stephen, who is Bishop of Truro, published a report on persecution of religious believers around the world and urged government action. He again was speaking this week, urging government to keep its commitments to implement the recommendations of his report. Boris Johnson appointed Fiona Bruce as his special representative for issues of freedom of religion and belief. David Burrows, who was an MP, now works as her deputy. He's actually an elder in an FIEC church. And we're really grateful for the work that they're doing to advocate for religious freedom for all people around the world. But at the moment, the media is largely ignoring that as a story.
Finally, Adrian, will we get out of the group?
Wales. I'm married to a Welsh woman.
Yeah, there we are then. Yeah.
Wales, I think, might win it.
Fair enough. no comment. Excellent.
Yeah, we'll get out.
Yeah, we will. But we might not get very much further. We shall see. Can I pick up, John? You mentioned the Bishop of Truro. Bishops have been in the news again since we last recorded. Bishop of Oxford, Bishop of Worcester, both coming out in favour of
coming out to slightly unfortunate.
Sorry, phrase, but yes, saying they're in favour of same-sex marriage. Yep. That is a huge departure from the Church of England's teaching on these matters. I think it's shocked a lot of people, our friends in Anglican circles. How do we respond to that?
Well, I wonder if you're right. I'm not sure it's a massive shock, because it's been clear within the Anglican Church there have been deep divisions over the whole issue of same-sex relationships and same-sex marriages for some time. So, for example, one of the bishops who've come out is the Bishop of Buckingham, is Alan Wilson. He's been arguing in favour of accepting gay relationships for a long time. Mm. So within the Anglican Church, it's not a new thing. I think the reason it's been such a shock is the Church of England has been in a process of discussing how it should respond to this. It's called Living in Love and Faith. Every parish, every church, the House of Bishops, Synod, have been debating what to do, and there are those lobbying for a change in the official position of the Church of England, which would allow same-sex marriages, same-sex relationship kind of blessings. There's the global Anglican Church, which is much more conservative on these issues, and groups like GAFCON, which have wanted to kind of maintain the historic position. And what was shocking about the Bishop of Oxford's position is that he made this public statement just after a gathering of the House of Bishops to discuss this kind of issue. So I don't know what to read from that, but I think it's the very fact that as the process was unfolding, he and others effectively broke cover demanding a kind of change. And I guess that suggests that the Church of England is heading to some sort of compromise in which some churches and parishes will be able to perform same-sex relationships and others won't. But that remains to be seen.
Perform same-sex marriages.
Same-sex marriages. But I mean, at one level, yeah, what we have here are kind of bishops, supposedly meant to be the teachers of doctrine within the Church of England, who are making clear that they reject the biblical teaching that sex is only for heterosexual marriage, and wanting to advocate for the acceptances right before God of loving kind of homosexual kind of relationships. So it's an abandonment, really, of biblical orthodoxy. It's an abandonment of the position that the church has held for 2,000 odd kind of years. I think that some very weak arguments are given scripturally to justify that position. Basically, the argument is there are people who suffer same-sex attraction, and it's not loving to not allow them to be able to express that, which in the end is an incredibly weak theological argument. And others have responded. So Vaughan Roberts, the rector of St. Ebbs, has written a long piece for the Latimer Trust, basically defending the kind of orthodox biblical position on sexuality. But this is a live fight within the Church of England between these different groups. That's actually reflected in a number of other denominations. So we've already seen the Church of Scotland has allowed sort of churches to perform same-sex relationships and allow clergy in same-sex marriages to be in ministry. The Methodist Church has done the same. Some denominations haven't taken a position, but they've not disciplined those that have taken that view. So within the Baptist Union, there are Baptist Union churches that conduct same-sex weddings, and the organisation has said they can't take action because they're independent churches. So this is a widespread phenomena within kind of churches in a Western context as to whether they're going to stand by the biblical teaching or whether they're going to go with the culture.
They're going to meet again, the bishops, in a few weeks' time, and we should be praying for that, obviously. Mm. To my mind, I think one of the worst outcomes would be a fudge. Mm. You know, an accommodation that allows everybody to have their own position. And I think the reason for that is we're looking at Jude at our leaders' conference, which maybe we'll talk about in just a moment, and it's very clear in Jude, it's very... very helped actually by John's session and talking about it with him beforehand. Jude obviously is dealing with not a kind of a return to a kind of Uber law, but actually a license. And he describes false teachers as ungodly people who pervert the grace of our God into a license for immorality and deny Jesus Christ, our only sovereign and Lord. Mm. You can't hold biblically, I don't think, to the position that says, well, we all believe that Jesus is King and Saviour and Lord, but we just interpret the moral commands slightly differently. That's not a tenable position. Mm. And so actually, once your solution is accommodation, you know, we're all Christians, we all believe that Jesus is the Son of God who came to die for us, but we just take different views on this. That's not a sustainable theological position. So actually, for people to be clear on this, I'm really praying for Anglicans to be clear on this. Mm. I fear it will be fudged, but I'm hoping it won't get fudged.
People can choose to step away, but that's a really difficult thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
People who are Anglican by conviction. How can we pray for our brothers and sisters in that position?
Well, I think for those who are within the Anglican Church, there are a whole range of options available to them. And I think there will be those who choose to stay in the Anglican Church and minister there. They that's the kind of vows they've taken to uphold that historic Anglican doctrine. And unless and until they're literally removed from their pulpits, they will want to keep preaching the gospel and caring for their congregations. There are those for whom there are other alternative Anglican structures and organisations. I was recently at a kind of consecration of new bishops for AMI in the kind of Anglican Church in Europe. And so there is an alternative structure of episcopal kind of oversight that is orthodox and upholds biblical sexuality. Now, that's outside of the established Church of England sort of position, but enables people to be authentically Anglican as part of the worldwide communion. And I think many of these issues are ecclesiological. So to be an Anglican is to hold certain convictions about the nature of the church, particularly about the nature of authority in the church and the position of kind of bishops. And if you are biblically convinced that that is the right way that church ought to be kind of ordered, then of course you need to belong within a grouping that upholds those biblical positions. For others in a variety of denominations, they might find that they sort of become independent or they join kind of different groups. So there are a number of people within the Anglican Church who've moved into, for example, Presbyterian ministry, the Free Church of Scotland or the IPC, because they can fit theologically with that. We've seen a number of churches from Methodist background, because of the decision on same-sex marriage, have left the Methodist Church and become independent churches and joined the FIEC. We've seen a couple of church plants and congregations that had left the Anglican Church or become part of Anglican groupings outside of the established Anglican Church ultimately decide to become independent congregations and join FIEC. So there is in fact a plethora of options. And I think that people who are wrestling with those questions in conscience before God under Scripture have to make the judgment. But actually, all of those options are costly. In many cases, they might mean people losing a building. They might mean losing some of your congregation. They might mean losing sort of pension support. They might mean losing a position in society and the respect that goes with that. So it's not at all easy for people to make those steps. But I think an increasing number of people, because they see the issue of sort of human sexuality as a gospel issue, that to affirm same-sex relationships, as we were saying from Jude, is actually to deny Jesus as Lord. It's essentially apostasy. That when that is seen, to sort of stay in a situation in which that is accepted, they just find that difficult in conscience.
It's a good reminder that following Christ is costly.
Yeah.
And serving Christ in the church is costly. There is a cost to that, which I don't think we've really felt in the West and certainly in the UK for the last 100 years, probably.
We're just talking about Qatar. That's persecution.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And nonconformists used to feel that more, actually, in the UK than we do at the moment, because there were so many things that were closed to us. But it's not bad to be reminded that actually this decision we've made to follow Christ and to serve him is one that comes at a cost, but it's a cost that's worth paying. So I think we need to pray for Anglican brothers and sisters who are taking a stand and putting themselves on the line, that they will count the name, you know, they will count it worthy to bear the name, and even if that means to suffer for it.
I mean, my prayer would be that within the Anglican Church, they would firmly uphold the position that they currently hold to, that the impact of the kind of global Anglican communion, and we must remember there are amongst the bishops many who are evangelical believers who would be clear themselves on sort of human sexuality and standing by a biblical position. They haven't come out in public and sort of spoken against the Bishop of Oxford yet, but they are there and they are part of the House of Bishops. And I think for all of us, for the sake of the gospel in the UK, if the Church of England stands firm for the biblical position, it makes it easier for all of us to stand firm for the biblical kind of position. So I think we ought to be praying that those in the Church of England who hold to those positions, particularly in high positions in the church, are bold, are clear, are willing to sort of pay the cost for that. And as I was saying at the leaders' conference, for us in FIEC, we've got a position on same-sex marriage that we adopted a number of years ago. We want to be clear on that, but we shouldn't underestimate the degree of pressure that we in our churches and our congregations come under. We can't take it for granted that we will stand firm. It's something we need to kind of help one another to kind of be clear, to reject the false teaching, to understand where the arguments are poor and inadequate. At the same time, we need to maintain that gracious, loving concern towards those who are same-sex attracted, particularly Christians who are struggling with same-sex attraction, that it's not just about fighting a principle, there's also a pastoral care. And we might find, certainly with the younger generation, it's much harder, I think, to make the case for sort of why people who feel same-sex attraction and want to experience love can't simply engage in sort of same-sex marriages. We were making the point that in the end, it does come down to the lordship of Jesus. If Jesus is Lord, you have to live the way that Jesus commands. And for every one of us, there are points in our life at which that is difficult and costly. And we said to the conference, actually, it may well be that people leave our churches because they don't like its teaching on same-sex relationships. And we can't simply be pragmatic. It's not simply about keeping as many people as we can and keeping people as happy as they are. This is an issue of apostasy, the truth of the gospel, and whether people are genuinely following the Lord Jesus. And every Christian evangelical group will face that challenge.
Well, John's sermon on Jude was one of a number of highlights at the conference last week. It was a good time, wasn't it, Adrian?
I think so, yeah. I enjoyed singing. I enjoyed being with people. I enjoyed seeing people I haven't seen for a long time. And it's just a reminder, isn't it, that the joy of being together, almost notwithstanding, I mean, I thought the content was excellent, by the way, especially the first sermon. I thought the content was excellent, but it almost notwithstanding the content, there's the joy of being together and sharing in that solidarity of the gospel. It was just a great help.
But all the talks.
6th to 8th of November, 2023.
Yeah, that's right.
Mark your diary.
In Blackpool, absolutely.
Well, essentially, we were remembering what we are as FIEC and that sort of sense that we were formed 100 years ago to basically stand firm for the core truths of the gospel, but to be generous on a whole variety of secondary issues. So a sort of a kind of a clarity on the gospel, but a unity. And it was great to have a room of 1,000 people who share those gospel convictions, but many of whom would vary on sort of the way that they do church, their convictions on baptism, the exact way the church is organized, their approach to kind of charismatic gifts. There was a kind of an evident larger number of younger leaders at the conference. There was a greater ethnic diversity. And that's what FIEC was kind of founded to be, that kind of unity in the core truths, but also to partner together to get the gospel out. As part of our kind of 100 projects, we were hearing about gospel work all around the country and what our churches are doing to reach their communities with the good news of the gospel. And in the end, that's what FIEC is about. It's about what the local churches are doing to build people up in Christ and get the gospel out to their communities. It was just great to be with the constituency after 3 years and be meeting lots of people and hearing what they're doing and how the Lord is growing and blessing their gospel work.
Three things then as we close. All the talks will be available on the website in the weeks to come. So that's both the talks from the main stage and the seminars. So do look out for those.
Crackers.
There are absolutely some great seminars we enjoyed last week. That's the first thing. Second thing is bookings for the Hub Conference are open. So just a reminder for that. So if you're looking to send people into training, do look out for the Hub Conference on our website. I think it's the 14th, 15th of January.
13th, 15th.
13th to 15th. I wasn't far off, was I? So that's coming up in January. Do book for that if you want to send people into training. And the third thing is we've launched this week a template complaints policy for churches. So do look out for that. That is for things that don't meet a kind of statutory threshold to report to the legal authorities, to the police, the local authority, but grievances that are raised. How do we help churches to think wisely about responding to those? And that template is there for you to use. So please do look out for that as well. Thank you for tuning in. This has been In the News at Independence, the FIEC podcast. Good to chat with you, John.
Come on, England.
Yeah. Wales as well, don't forget. Come on Wales. We look forward to speaking to you again soon. Do rate, leave a review, and do subscribe if you've enjoyed the content, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Cheers,
thanks
Phil.
Brothers,
thanks Phil.